podcast of the National Memorial for the Unborn. For those of you who are not familiar with the National Memorial for the Unborn, it's a ministry that has been established to honor children who have been lost to abortion, as well as miscarriage, and to heal the hurt that's been associated with that loss. The memorial itself is located in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and it's located on the former site of abortion clinic for the last 30 years. Today, in this podcast session, I'm joined by Boyd Samples, Pat Lindley, and Mike Jennings. Welcome to the podcast, everyone.
Thank you for having us.
So glad you're here. You guys have been a part of the memorial for quite a long time, and so I'm going to ask how you initially got involved in the pro-life community in this chamber. And why don't we start with Boyd?
Well, I started out as an attorney in what had been the largest law firm in the state of Tennessee, and I decided to leave in April of 1988. While I had been there, I was on the hiring committee and interviewed a young man named Mike Jennings, who was an exceptional lawyer. He was first in his class, very, very mature, very Christian. And after I left, Mike came to me, said that he had been praying and that he felt God was leading him to join me in practice. Well, that's quite a change going from such a big firm to such a small firm. But on January 1st, 1989, we became partners. On the first Saturday in January of 1989, 46 protesters at the abortion clinic were arrested. They had chained themselves together, placed their chains in quick-setting cement, chained themselves to the front door, and generally blocked access to the clinic. Of course, the police made a big deal out of this. They brought out the paddy wagons, they brought out the camera crews, and they arrested all of them. And they wanted to make these people an example so that this would not happen before. One of the leaders in that group, Bill Tickle, was an amazing man who was willing to give himself up, as were all the others. Bill just recently passed, and Mike and Pat and I all had the opportunity to visit with him shortly before his passing. And he was Christian to the very end, a great example. So we were approached by these people to represent them. And I told Mike that's a really bad idea for two reasons. Number one, we didn't practice criminal law. And number two, they couldn't pay us. Now listen, we just started a new law firm. We had to pay rent and secretaries and equipment and all the things that go with that. And to take on 46 non-paying clients is not a move you find in most business books. But Mike said, let's pray about it. And we did. And we decided to take those 46 people. We had them sign a piece of paper that they were going to jail and that they wouldn't sue us when they went to jail. It was the only thing worse than that. People in jail is people who have no time wanting to sue you. So they did. We went to the first hearing in city court, which was literally a meat market. People were packed in like sardines, and I felt a lady brush by me, and I felt intense cold. And I asked someone, who was that? They said, that's one of the women who owned the abortion clinic. I had come in contact with evil incarnate. Well, we had raised what's called the necessity defense, meaning if you have a child who's choking and you're driving too fast to get to the hospital, that's permissible. You see a child in a burning building, you go in and save it. That's not a trespass. Mike developed some excellent research, some of it going back to the Civil War. As they say, old law is good law. And we brought that before the judge. City court bound them all over, and now they went to adult court. They picked out 8 examples to try and show that they didn't want this to happen again. But these were misdemeanor cases, and yet the two prosecutors they assigned to the case were felony cases. These people tried murders, rapes, and all the terrible crimes and these were misdemeanors. Then there was Mike and me, who we might not have known where the courtroom was, but we figured it out. And on the first morning of trial, we presented our necessity defense. And Judge Meyer said something that I remember to this day. "It's a very interesting defense, Mr. Samples, but I'm not going to let you use it. And there is nothing you can say that will ever change my mind." We called time out, went out in the hall. I looked around at the people and said, "We have no defense. They've got pictures of you chained to each other, chained to the front door. Your chains are in buckets of cement." And the little man next to me looked up and said, "It's okay. We did what God wanted us to do." Just broke my heart, humbled me. We spent the rest of the day picking a jury, not knowing that there were people who wanted to be on that jury. And the next morning, the first witness was the business manager for the clinic, who was going to testify about how much money they had lost. This had disrupted their business. But I had found a pamphlet where the clinic was advertising second trimester abortions in a non-surgical ambulatory care center. And I brought that to the court's attention. And the court said, "Well, the attorney general has declared that unconstitutional, but no court has. That's only the word of a man. Mr. Samples, I just changed my mind." Now, that was a God thing, coming from a man who said he'd never change his mind. Well, the courtroom went to an uproar, and the prosecutors wanted to object. And I went up to Judge Meyer and said, "Look, Judge, you and I both know I don't know what I'm doing." And he said, "You're doing pretty good so far." And I said, "What do they want to do? I object to." So we objected. And because the jury had already been sworn, double jeopardy attached, and they had to dismiss all the claims against all the people. Pat Lindley here, who was the director of AAA Women's Center then, had always told me, "If you can speak live on TV, say what you want. You can't edit it." So Mike and I went out, and they were expecting us to extol our virtues as incredible lawyers. Instead, we said, "Today, God has wrought a great victory." See, God took some very ordinary people like Mike and me, not even qualified to be called to this calling, and yet we trusted him. And he delivered in such a way that it's impossible. I'll let one of the others pick the story up about the purchase of the clinic and ProMac.
Sure, we'll do that. But I wanted to find out how Pat first got involved.
I really can't trace exactly when I first got involved in pro-life efforts. I know when I started doing things, but I was pregnant in 1973, firstborn.
That was when Roe v. Wade was.
He was born in the spring of 74. But all that time, I just couldn't believe that we could, as a society, just say these children are the wrong children. They are just easily to be destroyed. Desire of so much has changed in the years since then, for sure, in what we understand about fetal development, to how early there's a heartbeat. Those were things that really weren't known 50 years ago,
right?
But that sense of we as believers need to stand for the voiceless little ones. It's a matter of compassion for them who is desperate enough that she feels like that's her only option. We really felt like if she just knew, it would make a difference. What it has. But that sense that we, the church with a capital C, need standing in that gap, that has been one of the greatest dreams of the got to know these two partners, just about the time that their firm started and the first rescue took place. And I think we would, all of us who were part of it in those early days here in Chattanooga, just felt like it was the greatest honor. Two of those, Hoyt mentioned our friend Bill Chickle, the other, Dr. Dennis Bazzaga, who left us. And just people with the conviction to do what is right. And so Dennis, in particular, some others were involved in starting the place that needed to be the refuge right across the street from the abortion clinic. It was, the clinic was Chattanooga Women's Clinic that we used in those days. The three A's got ahead of the so given to the pregnancy some of those triple services. And, many times the word confused people, nervous coming around the corner there and things ready to stop. First one would be something. And those children, center of the team.
Triple A?
Yes.
Incorporated in
1980. Yeah. And that, we opened across the street. I joined up with those folks.
Across the street from the?
From the abortion.
Which is court.
Which is. Should take it.
All right, keep going. You're doing spectacular.
Okay, so being right across the street, and having gotten a whole lot of attention with a life change, something that people were doing in place. And just, we realize that this community does not want this place. It's tucked away over there. Very little over there, just kind of close to the airport, but just tucked away, not in a lot of public attention. Realized that there was much support for those who would stand for the lives of those children, to support the center. It became truly a place of refuge through the seniors. Little lives saved, those of us who were involved there. Having that incredible thrill of holding the baby, had been handed to us by the mother that chose the abortion. But the rescue and other purposes, they heightened our presence in the minds of the people being as well. We had a whole lot of different churches involved.
When you say we, are you referring to Womack? Is that the
organization
that you're referring to?
I guess in the late 80s that we established, would you say that?
Yeah, you know, again, to answer your question, I came to town in 1984.
Okay.
Actually, I started my law practice 40 years ago today.
Congratulations.
And I came to town, my wife and I were married. We've been active in, you know, some pro-life stuff in Georgia where I went to school. We came here and we looked for that community and found that in large part the church that we joined when we came up here and held several of these activists, folks who were not just talking it, but were doing the walk, and Dennis Bazzaco being one of them. He was very magnetic. You couldn't be around Dennis without being pulled into that vortex. And, you know, he introduced us to Lindley's and others that involved who were from different denominational background. And PROMAC is an acronym for the Pro-Life Majority Coalition of Chattanooga. Mm-hmm. That name was Doug Godfrey's brainchild. He's the one who thought that up. He said, hey, everybody's doing different things, and we need to have kind of a common clearinghouse where everybody knows what everybody else is doing. There were pro-life student groups on the campuses, Bethany Christian Services, kind of focused on adoption stuff. There was AAA, the Crisis Pregnancy Center, doing kind of some of the intervention stuff. There were the sidewalk counselors that were making, finding out when the clinic was going to be open, making appointments to try to intervene between the appointment. Things like the Life Chain community-wide events, people engaging different churches and making sure the churches on you and everybody. So for the pro-life organization and pro-life majority coalition, which had as members, people from all these organizations who would come together and have a meeting and everybody would know what's going to be. Use that as a big umbrella to coordinate community-wide things. That would be, for some people that were like, you know, I do not feel led to get arrested, chain myself to concrete in front of a door, but I will do this or that. And so that could be all coordinated through the pro-medic. And so you didn't have to be all in that sense, to be all in the sense that I want to be.
Just
picking
up on that, I think we could tag team the buying the clinic story. But after that happened, my name ended up in the newspaper, and I started getting from people in so many different places. A little tagline went out on the newswire. And so people from all over the country picked up on this story. And if there's one thing that we could pick, because we never know what is my thoughts to say. When the Lord lifts the curtain, we see certain things. Mm-hmm. But the sense of unity was, I think if there's any one thing that should be a takeaway to pro-life people in this city, everywhere, is the unity. It was perfectly played out in those pro-life meetings that there were people who just weren't even thinking to smart chain yourself to a door, but the love that existed, the sense of call to be the voice for the unborn, to do the hard thing. If there was anything I could say to people, how did this happen? Was only could have made this happen. But I really felt like the sense of God's people coming together, of caring and supporting one another's convictions. Was such a
okay. So we are now at 1993.
Yes.
So tell us that story, because it's so fascinating. I want everybody to know the story. You cannot not know the story.
Let me say right before that Pat and Linda Brown and Mike went to James Dobson's Focus on the Family, and this story was told internationally, and people heard that story. One was a roofer in Indiana who understood we needed a roof, and he put a roof on free. Another painter driving along the freeway in St. Louis was inspired, and he drew the painting, I Shall Hold You in Heaven, which now is at the National Memorial. You can buy a print for that to help support the National Memorial. So in 1983, things come to a head.
1993, yes. Okay.
Yeah, the clinic was owned by a local prominent landlord. He was having some financial difficulties. He leased premises to Ed Perry, who was a doctor from Elizabethton, Tennessee. He was an Army reservist, and he would sometimes fly into that airport wearing camouflage fatigues and perform abortions in the clinic, and they would move the dates around trying to keep the protesters away, move the dates around. It was a cash-only operation. So he would leave town at the end of the day with a lot of cash in his satchel. What happened was the landlord got in a little bit of financial difficulty and was negotiating a possible sale of the building to the abortionists. The landlord had filed bankruptcy. So that sale had to be approved by the bankruptcy court. So a notice went out to all of the landlord's creditors notifying them of a possible pending transaction involving the property. One of the creditors was a very small creditor in terms of the amount of dollars owned. he was pro-life. He notified one of the individuals who happened to be on that Cromack board. That notification came on a Thursday night. It was the quarterly meeting of the board was scheduled. Word came that day.
Wow.
And I just got this notice.
I didn't know that one.
So we assembled as usual, had a discussion, and the question was, man, wouldn't it be great? The proposition was, wouldn't it be great to buy the building and shut it down? Mm-hmm. And hypothetically, that'd be great. This is Thursday, and any objections to the proposed sale have to be filed by Monday. I'm the treasurer. I don't know, remember how much money we have, but we couldn't have been more than $100 or $200. We don't have any money. This is not a money organization. But the question was, if we had the money, would we do it? Mm-hmm. And part of the discussion was, well, that building's not worth that amount of money. They're going to go somewhere else. But the consensus after the discussion was, yeah, if we had the money, we would do it. So then we said, well, why don't we ask the Lord to give us the money? And so that was at the conclusion of that meeting, then word went out.
Okay, so by Monday, just phone calls, word of mouth, but Mike and another lawyer called me and said, we were over $200,000. What do you think we should do? And we thought, let's put in an objection and see what happens. And what happened was...
Because what was pending in the bankruptcy court was the abortionist was going to buy it for
$264,000.
Okay. $254,000. We did $64,000. We still didn't have anywhere.
Yeah, we don't have any money. And even what we had was people saying, I'll give you this. There wasn't. Still wasn't anything in the bank.
Okay.
But the rest of the week, people, word of mouth again, and some of the people that we thought, oh, you know, nothing to them to throw in the other $100,000, whatever, just didn't felt like, they felt like that they would just open somewhere else kind of thing. But little by little, some of those stories, we have them written down, have them recorded. One of the pastors who was on the coalition's wife was looking out the window and saw an elderly lady with a handkerchief full of coins, and it was less than $10, and she just handed it to her and said, this is to save the babies.
Satan was involved in this. He was fighting the pro-life people, and he was telling them, look, you can buy the building, but I'm just going to open up down the road, then you've spent all this money for nothing. Mm. Because when the devil comes to you, he gives rational arguments.
Yes.
He gives easy ways out. But it took faithful people like Promac and led by Pat and by Mike to see through that and to say, if God wants this, God will deliver it. And he did.
So fast forward to the courtroom that morning.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's Friday. This is 8 days after word first comes in. And Dick Crotto, another lawyer in town who's in a very big law firm, happens to convince one of his bankruptcy partners to file an objection on behalf of Promac, bankruptcy partner who subsequently became a bankruptcy judge. And she appeared in court on our behalf to represent us. And the judge decided that this was a legitimate filing to challenge that, and basically it was saying there's a better offer. This offer's low, there's a better offer. And so he said he was going to convene a auction, and the auction was going to, be in $5,000 increments. And so DeCrotto and I were on the front row of the spectator section in the courtroom, and it happened to be on Friday was a motion day for bankruptcy lawyers. Neither Dick Crotto nor I are bankruptcy lawyers, and I'd never even been in that building. But the lawyers who are there regularly kind of figured out what was going on. This is very unusual. And, so in the course of the discussion back and forth, two of those lawyers came up and leaned over the rail to me and Dick. And one of them said, if you need more money, I'm good for $500. Mm-hmm. The other one said, if you need more money, I'm good for $10,000. And we needed both of us. Because the came back, I think, after lunch. And
In between, went back to Mike's office. And the one that I remember, too, is young couple who had followed Larry Burkett, who does the financial planning stuff. And so instead of paying a lot of interest on a car loan, they were taking that much money and putting it away. And they brought that money.
Wow.
We'll just wait. We'll wait for a car. I mean, it was that sort of Frank Peretti kind of experience, if any of you have read those old Frank Peretti books, of us just really watching it happen. So we went back into the courtroom that afternoon with 294.
That was our cap, right?
Yeah.
So we told our lawyer, we want you, we'll start off, theirs is 254 and we'll five, and then but every time it comes back to you, instantly raise it five, instantly raise five, no hesitation. But you need to know we can't go past 294. And so, you know, and every time Dr. Perry made a bid, he'd confer with his lawyer and back and forth, and they would make their bid. Mm-hmm. And so then it got down to he made his last bid, like 289. We said 294.
Well, and then
as confident as we could be.
Best movement then was that his lawyer made this impassioned speech that we were nothing but a bunch of street rowdies, and our lawyer stood up, and it was mostly ones, but it was a lot because people were bringing cash. She just stood there tapping it, and then she said, "Well, Your Honor, today my clients are dealing in cash."
Yes, and at that when we made our last bid, Ed Perry stood up, he turned around, he walked out of the courthouse, and we never saw him again.
Wow.
We sued him later.
Yeah.
But then because it was a federal courthouse, you know, we went, security was not a big thing in 1993, like it is everywhere we go now. But the reporters had gotten wind of it, and they were all out on the steps with their cameras. And I was asked the question, because one of them, who was the one with the access to the AP wires, had done her homework in between, and she saw what the building had appraised for, and it was less than $200,000. She asked, wasn't that just a big waste of a lot of money? And I didn't even have a chance to think about it, but the thing that popped out of my mind was, you can never put a price tag on the life of even one child. And she laughed derisively, but she thought, what are these people, are idiots? And that's the line she put out on the AP wires, and that's what went nationally.
Right.
And
because you really can't.
Yeah. And so at that point, and the other thing was, the two of us and the other lawyer were wanting me to be very careful with what I said. And one of them said, well, what are we going to do with the building? And we stopped and looked at each other and said, what are we going to do with the building? And I felt more surprised than I realized. I didn't think that was going to really go our way. Mm-hmm. And all we said then was, what we know we aren't going to do with it is to let what has gone for these years continue, and we're going to put it to good use.
The lease expired. Mm-hmm. Clinic moved out, took possession. It's pretty sobering what we found inside. But then, you know, a decision was made that we're going to put that crisis pregnancy center right here. And we're going to take the other half of the building. It was shaped like an L. Mm-hmm. We're going to take the other half of that building, and we're going to do something significant here to memorialize that part of the building was where the procedures had taken place. We're going to do something here to memorialize the thousands of babies that died here. And that was the genesis of the birth of the National Memorial for the Unborn.
It started out as Imago Dei, if I'm not mistaken. And so how'd you guys come up with that name?
That's Doug's idea. I think he's always clever with these things. Of course, Imago Dei, the image of God.
Yes.
And he originally had there's so many things that Chattanooga's tied with, And this abortion clinic is just the most recent one. But, you know, if you want to talk about the Cherokee removal, if you want to talk about slavery and the war, and there are all kinds of instances where people made in the image of God have been treated as something less than that.
Yes.
And, you know, so, but, so hence the name. But out of that, the focus after a while sifted down to, well, let's focus on what took place here. And that was the death of children.
Mm-hmm. And Mark Caldwell was very instrumental in getting the wall up and helping to fund that, as were many others. And today, I think it's an 80-foot granite wall.
50-foot granite wall.
And there are names on that wall from all over the United States, all over the world, so that people can remember their unborn children. And now that has become a virtual wall, so that you can go onto the internet and place plaques, virtual plaques, to your unborn baby, giving women a great sense of closure and something that many, many women need, and men need as well.
Yes, it's amazing. And we love the fact that we've been able to, in this 30th anniversary year, be able to launch that virtual wall. Mm-hmm. We do have an opportunity for those of you who have nameplates on the actual wall and you can't come to visit us. Please, please take advantage of the opportunity to go to our website, memorialfortheunborn.org, and you will see where it says virtual wall. You'll click on there. There are 10 panels that have thousands of names on them. And if you find the name of your, you can do a search for the name of your child. You can click on there and you can actually leave a tribute. You can leave a poem or a song or a verse to your child. And so we're so thankful to God for being able to provide that service to those of you who have experienced the loss of your child through abortion.
And what I experienced as being forced to be the designated spokesperson, there were plenty of people who were speaking out against it. But when the voice of the woman who can honestly share her loss became a voice, none of the others wanted to say, especially in even more so in the current culture where everything is about feelings and whatever a person feels. Well, this is a...
You cannot negate that woman's personal experience.
Right.
And, you know, I've got two brothers that did not survive birth. So there's a cemetery that I can go to, and their names are there.
Yes.
Because I never met them, but they have real meaning and value in the eyes of the Lord. So I think, Regina, you know this, and every woman who's got a plaque on there understands that. There's not we didn't have a body to bury.
Right.
But that child was significant. That child is significant. And by naming that child and putting that plaque up there, you're saying you have worth.
Yes. And it's a visible, it's tangible. It's not something that's out there in the ethereal. It's very real. I remember when I placed my nameplate on the wall in honor of my son, Adam, it was the most freeing, the most liberating. It was that moment that I really, truly embraced the forgiveness of God and honored that child. And I'm so looking forward to meeting him in eternity. So yes, it's powerful that you cannot walk on that ground and not experience the power of the Holy Spirit, the presence of God. It's amazing to me. It's just amazing. And I resisted for a long time.
And people need to understand that this affects a lot of Christian men and women.
Yes.
There are lots of Christians who have gone through the tragedy of an abortion and they feel guilt. They feel like they have committed a sin for which they cannot be forgiven. And yet Jesus says, come unto me and I will forgive your sin. And one of the ways of them working through that is to come to the wall and place a plaque and confront and understand that Jesus loves you. Get rid of that guilt and get on with the work that Jesus has for you in this life.
Yes. We conduct a monthly memorial service, and we are constantly placing nameplates on the wall. And people are coming from all over the country to participate in those memorial services. They make it a priority for themselves. The last few have come from North Carolina and from Pennsylvania and from Virginia. And so we look forward to serving them. And it's such a joy to see them walk in kind of overwhelmed, but to leave full of joy, knowing that there's a representation of their child that's public and visible and tangible. So,
and the beauty of it, that so many things that just unfolded with it that are so meaningful. And one of them is that there was a structural post in the middle that we could not take down. And the Lord told somebody, put a cross around it, yes. It covers it. And at different times of the day, the sun will cast the shadow back on different places. It's just
to physically get to the wall, you have to get to the cross first.
Yes, indeed. I love that part of it.
So that was a God thing. That wasn't anything we figured out.
Gotta keep the roof up.
Yes.
Well, one of the things that has really been very poignant for me is being able to read that letter from the lady that left it, woman who had an abortion at that clinic, left it in the rubble of the building.
Right, the night we knocked it down.
And when it was knocked down, and to be able to have that, you know, her story is a part of that wall. Mm. And so we're just so grateful that she's had a place to be able to mourn her child.
And we always saw that as here's the next step, that we came back in the morning and it was just rubble. Mm-hmm. And there's a flower arrangement and that handwritten letter.
Yes. This is it. So, and it's made such a powerful impact on the lives of so many people. And so I'm so grateful that all of you were involved. I thank you so much for your service to this organization, being on the board, being with POMAC, being a part of getting this site redeemed from what it was to what it is now. So thank you so much. Thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having us.
And thank you guys for listening. We value your time and we appreciate you listening in. And want to make sure that you like us and share this podcast with others. And for those of you who have experienced the trauma of abortion, we would love to be able to share your story, especially if you have a nameplate on the wall. You can contact us at office@memorialfortheunborn.org. That's our email address. Again, that's office@memorialfortheunborn.org. And we would love to be able to tell your story. And also, please make sure you go to the website and visit and take a look at the virtual wall and see what your donations have wrought, because it's powerful when you read the inscriptions that are there. You see that this is not something that is describing a blob of tissue. This is describing a human being. So thank you so much for joining us on this podcast.